Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and today is a national day of activism to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline. If you're not following the Dakota Access Pipeline story yet, some of the basics. On Friday afternoon, the Obama administration took a stand for Native American rights when it temporarily blocked the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. This announcement came mere minutes after a federal judge denied the Standing Rock Sioux tribe's request for an injunction on the pipeline's construction. The tribe claimed the pipeline would destroy sacred sites and corrupt the community's drinking water if it ever leaked or failed. Today, support rallies are scheduled around the country, hoping the temporary block becomes permanent. With us now is Winona LaDuke, longtime Native American activist and executive director of the group Honor the Earth. She lives and works on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, but she traveled to Dakota to join the protest. And Mark Trahat, independent journalist and journalism professor at the professor, is it the University of North Dakota? Is that where you are?
That's correct.
Thanks for joining us. And Winona LaDuke, thanks to you for joining us. Hello from New York.
Well, hello.
Mark, can you start and give maybe listeners who have not followed the Dakota Access Pipeline story yet some context as to why this local issue is breaking out as a national story?
Well, the main reason it's breaking out as a national story is the power of social media. The context is that the Dakota Access Pipeline partners picked a route that was 97% supposed to be a slam dunk without requiring any federal approval. They had the Army Corps of Engineers. They thought they were going to be able to send that through a very pro forma process. For more than a year now, some of us have been writing about the objections for the tribe, so it's not a surprise. But the Army Corps of Engineers basically was blind to that, made the approval. And that's when the digging was supposed to go for the pipeline underneath the Missouri River is when the public part of the protest actually started to spread.
And is this, through your eyes as a journalist in the region, mostly about Native American land rights and the feeling that they'd be taken for granted by running this pipeline, which always could potentially leak, through their area where it could contaminate the water supply? Is it about that? Or is this a larger anti-global warming, let's not support the fossil fuels industry, environmental thing, like the other big pipeline debate was in the last few years?
The answer is yes, both. It certainly could have been that at the beginning. I think if the Dakota Access partners were smart, they would have kind of figured that early on in this debate, but now there's no way this is not about the larger issue. And the UN, in its most recent review, says that we've got to stop building large infrastructure projects that will carry more oil, and it's almost exactly along the lines of this particular project.
Winona LaDuke, tell us what you think is at stake here from a Standing Rock Sioux tribe perspective.
Well, if you just kind of look at the big picture, these people have never really had justice, and this is the tip of the iceberg. You know, they had a lot of things taken from them. They had the river dam their territory and took 95% of their, you know, trees and 75% of their wildlife. And then they've been, you know, hanging in up there, and nothing has gotten better from that for them. And now all of a sudden everybody wants their land or their, you know, to go across their territory with this pipeline that's not even going to benefit them and put all the risk on them. It could have gone north of Bismarck, you know, and put at risk the city of Bismarck. But no, they had to put at risk the Standing Rock people because the city of Bismarck didn't want it up there. So, you know, it's an environmental justice issue from that perspective. It's an issue of self-determination. Who gets to determine the future of a nation and, you know, who gets to be sure that their water is safe? And then to me, it is also this big infrastructure question. You know, I've spent a lot of time fighting pipelines. I mean, the pipeline company that just bought this pipeline, Enbridge, largest pipeline company in North America, has been trying for 4 years to put exactly the same pipeline through our territory. It was called the Sandpiper. We spent 4 years, really, really hard work, every tribe. You know, every tribal citizen, a lot of northern Minnesota people went out and we put the skids on this pipeline. They were getting nowhere in their regulatory process because we forced them to do a full EIS. And then all of a sudden they drop that project, Sandpiper, and move over. Enbridge buys one-third of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So, you know, from my perspective, a dirty pipeline here or a dirty pipeline there doesn't make any difference. We don't need any new fossil fuel infrastructure. We don't need to risk our water anymore. And, you know, in an era and in a time when the country, the United States, has a D in infrastructure, Indian country certainly has a D minus in infrastructure. We don't even have suitable drinking water in most of the villages on my reservation. You know, what we need is infrastructure for people, not for oil companies. And I think that the, you know, UN has hit that. It's not only just dirty oil infrastructure in a time of climate change. It's also, what do you need for human rights? You need, you know, we need those pipes to go to Flint, Michigan. They need our pipes. We don't need those pipes out there.
So this is really fully both for you. This isn't just not in my backyard, not in my fellow tribe's backyard. We've been abused by the United States government and taken for granted long enough. This is also the big stop the fossil fuels industry infrastructure. Let's move to renewables for the sake of the earth cause, as far as you're concerned. It's both.
Of course it is. I mean, just to, you know, I mean, Mark will have something else to say about it, but I'll give you a perfect example. 3 years ago, on the Standing Rock Reservation, a woman named Debbie Dogskin died, froze to death, because she could not pay her propane bill. Just south of that Bakken, you know, oil-producing range, could not pay her propane bill, so she froze to death in the middle of a super cold winter when there was a spike in propane prices brought to us by the oil companies. So let me know how this situation, this pipeline, which traverses their territory and goes from the Bakken to someplace else, is going to help the Debbie Dogskins of the world. The fact is that, you know, Standing Rock needs solar thermal panels on their houses so that they can heat their houses. That's what we're going to be working on with the tribe. Standing Rock needs access to clean water. Their clinic is, you know, everything out there is very tough. And what we need to do is be building, you know, infrastructure that makes a difference for people and doesn't, you know, line the pockets of oil companies. But also, you know, Mark, you're up there in North Dakota, but, you know, for crying out loud, no one has been paying attention to North Dakota from what I can figure for, you know, 50 years, and they've developed a little oil fiefdom of dysfunctional regulation up there, which is a shame, is an absolute shame in a democracy.
Mark, want to pick that up?
Oh, this state is very well captured by oil. In fact, most of the politicians are not only advocating for oil, but they're investors in it. And that's pretty clear from the public record. One point that I want to make that I think is interesting in the framing of this debate is the oil industry really does want this to be an either-or discussion, that we're either going to have access to oil for cars and such, or we're not. And that's really way beyond. Most of what this is slowing the production and the slowing the distribution of a fossil fuel. Because if you're going to start turning it around, you've got to start somewhere. You can't keep growing. And the oil industry's own data says the whole goal of this pipeline is to increase. In fact, right now, they want to start with 470,000 barrels a day, but by the end of the decade, they want this pipeline to be flowing about 570,000. So they're already using this as a mechanism not just to keep status quo, but to increase consumption.
Listeners, any calls for our guest, Winona LaDuke, director of the group Honor the Earth from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, but she's involved in this North Dakota state nearby issue where the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is trying to fight this Dakota Access Pipeline. And also journalist Mark Trahant, who's also a journalism professor at the University of North Dakota, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Steve in Airmont, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Yes, good morning. You know, Brian, I have to say that that most, if not all, Americans who have not traveled in the Native American areas, especially in the Four Corners area of the Southwest or the area that's being talked about have any idea of what's going on. I am stunned in the 21st century that a federal judge would have sided with the interests of big oil to further defile this whole thing. It's horrible and disgusting, and it's really wrong. And I have to say, I'll give the Obama administration a lot of credit for doing something, because until you see it for your own eyes, until you actually go on the reservations and stuff and look at that and see what's happening, mm-hmm. It doesn't come through in newspaper articles or magazine. It's not the same.
I understand. Steve, thank you very much. So, Mark, can you explain the context of the court ruling? Because, again, some of the sequence of events here is that the court denied the tribe's request for an injunction to stop the pipeline, but then the Obama administration stepped in and issued basically a presidential order to temporarily halt the pipeline. So what was the judge's ruling based on? What was the legal question here?
Well, the main legal question for the judge is there enough evidence to support a temporary restraining order? And he's got to have that higher standard of likely to win at trial. And he basically reached the opposite conclusion. I think he looked at it very narrowly, and if you read his finding, it's pretty narrow. Again, being 97% of the pipeline does not require regulation, which in itself is extraordinary. But the judge was just looking at those very narrow issues. The administration has been working on this for quite a while, and I've been trying to find out how long, but there's no way that three federal agencies reacted to the court decision in that amount of time. It must have been in the works probably from the beginning of the public stand down at Standing Rock, because that's how the nature of government works.
And Winona LaDuke, you're comfortable with the president stepping in and saying by presidential decree, even after a court has approved it, that a private sector thing cannot go forward?
Of course I am. I mean, it's a trust responsibility, but we need a little bit more strength, you know, from the Obama administration. Those permits should really be revoked, you know, because a lot of permits were issued. They truncated the whole process, so it was one little piece, one little piece, one little piece, one little piece. There's no big EIS being done on this, and I would guarantee you that this would not pass a full EIS.
So what's the next thing that you hope the administration does, since this is just a temporary injunction?
Well, you know, I would like to see that the process is stopped until there's a full review, a full environmental review, you know, of this proposed pipeline. And then the other side is, let me be honest, is I think we need a solution. And, you know, I do agree with Mark. There's a couple of pieces in this. One is that this is right now a pipeline from nowhere. You got an 85% drop in active drilling rigs in the Bakken. They're hoping that things get better. But, you know, I don't know when that's going to be. And so, you know, if you drive out to western North Dakota right now, it used to be full of oil tankers, you know, oil trains, bomb trains. It is not right now. Things are, you know, at the bottom in the Bakken. So why would you be building a pipeline from nowhere, you know, at present? We need to question these infrastructure. And then really, you know, I do go back to, you need infrastructure for people. Send those pipes to Flint. Make those, you know, make some infrastructure for that reservation. And second, you know, they need basically a Marshall Plan for Standing Rock. And that's what the president should do. You know, he was out there on that reservation. I think there's only three presidents that have ever gone to an Indian reservation. You know, time to put some solar and wind in that community. Time to address the basic infrastructure needs of the community. So when they get out of this, it's not only that there's no pipeline that contaminates them, but they have something which is good for their community. That's what I think Obama should do.
Catherine in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm calling to give my absolute, complete support of these people and their fight to save the water and the earth. And for the oil company that hired those incompetent, poorly trained dog handlers, I know about dog training, the dogs weren't properly trained, the handlers were not properly trained. And then to be releasing them and allowing them to attack people was beyond the pale. Those people should be arrested. and it just demonstrates the moral decay of our corporate elite. We need to stop this fossil fuel madness. Most of this Balkan oil and tar sands and whatever you want to call it is for export. It's to increase the profits of a rapacious oil industry.
Catherine, thank you very much. Mark, I think it's possible that there wouldn't be national attention to this issue if there wasn't an incident during the protests in North Dakota. Were you there for that?
I was. The whole social media part of the story is really phenomenal. It was not the White House press corps that asked President Obama what was going on at Standing Rock. It was a Laotian student. And that's something that only would have happened from people sharing stories on Facebook and other social media and getting the word out, because the media was just really slow to react. There's another interesting twist to that. And the state of North Dakota charged Amy Goodman for criminal trespass.
That's Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now! On Pacifica and on television. Uh-huh.
For being recording the story of the dog's attack. And yet the Bismarck TV stations that were on the exact same land at the exact same time telling their version of the story for North Dakota audiences were not charged.
Are you suggesting it's because Amy Goodman is seen as more of an activist and therefore an enemy of their cause?
Exactly.
I would say it's because Amy Goodman actually had footage. I mean, the fact was is that she was out there and she got the footage of the dogs going after the people. And none of those other reporters, I mean, I actually went to the Fargo Forum last week and, you know, after this, and I said, hey, you guys, man, this is on the New York Times, and you got national media covering it. Where's your coverage? And, you know, we got to the second section bottom, you know, below the fold here this last week. We've been on the front page a few times, but, you know, I just think that North Dakota media has got to step up and actually be independent media and not oil-controlled media. And I also think that the reason that they went after Amy is because she had footage of what happened.
Mark, for you as a journalist in the area, not everyone in the area is against the pipeline. I want to play a clip of Kerry Hoff, a bus driver in downtown Bismarck, on Morning Edition today.
You know what? If they can put the pipeline right through here, it wouldn't bother me. And oil is big business in the state, and it generates a lot of tax dollars, you know. You got to keep the state coffers full the way it is with tax dollars.
So, Mark, how much would you say North Dakotans are divided on this?
Oh, I think North Dakotans are probably, as a rule, pro-oil. You see it reflected in how it's not a partisan debate. The Democrats are just as pro-oil as the Republicans. But again, as Winona pointed out, the price of oil has really affected this debate. One of the most eerie things, if you drive across North Dakota now, is if you look at these huge man camps that were existing, and they're just vacant. And it shows what's just happened to this big bonanza that folks thought would last forever.
Deborah and Rockberry are on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thanks so much for covering this. And I know there has begun to be a little bit of media coverage on it with the New York Times. But I wondered if Winona LaDuke had any advice to the media and to those of us who've been following this issue for the last, it seems like, going on for more than a month. What can we do to get this more in the mainstream media? I've been writing to some of the television stations and asking why they're not covering this, because I think it's important for people to understand what's going on and that this is occurring in the absence of an environmental impact statement. The National Environmental Policy Act requires that any time we have infrastructure being put into communities that may have negative or positive impacts, it has to be properly reviewed. And outcry and community opposition to it can sometimes be a trigger to initiating an EIS over just a simple environmental assessment. The media needs to be able to cover this, and I'm looking for advice for how do we get this more in the mainstream media so more people are aware of this travesty.
Deborah, thank you. And Winona, make this your last answer and closing answer. Question and also in general, where do you see the movement going right now?
Well, you know, a couple of things. Keep on it. Keep, you know, pay attention to North Dakota. I mean, what's going on out there? Don't just fly over it. Things are going poorly. Second is that this is a broader issue. I mean, someone needs to start looking into the corruption of North Dakota politics and how dysfunctional it got. Because it got this way, this pipeline is just a flash on it. You know, and then the third is remember, this is a national problem. You've got infrastructure all over this country that has fallen apart. You've got oil leaks and gas leaks. We need to really address it. So what's going on in North Dakota is your problem, too, up there in New York. Everybody's problem is what's going on with oil infrastructure.
Winona LaDuke, executive director of the group Honor the Earth. She lives and works on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, but has gotten involved in this Dakota Access Pipeline issue in North Dakota with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And we thank Mark Trahant, also journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. Thank you both so much for giving us this time. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we may not like it, but the Obamacare health insurance exchanges are in some real trouble. It doesn't mean they're collapsing or in a death spiral, as the professional naysayers like to put it, but the model is not working as planned so far to draw in enough younger, healthier insurance buyers to provide all buyers with robust insurance at stable, reasonable prices with lots of choice of insurance companies and doctors. As has been widely reported, Aetna is pulling out of the exchanges now in 11 of its 15 states. United Health is going down to just 3 states out of its original 34. One local example is Oscar Health Insurance, a startup created specifically because of the opportunity that Obamacare exchanges seem to offer. Oscar has marketed itself as a new kind of consumer-friendly insurance company for the digital age, starting out in New York, New Jersey, and I believe just 2 other states, but it's already leaving the New Jersey exchanges. Oscar becomes the 3rd company to either leave or cancel plans to expand in New Jersey. And Oscar sent a letter to its New York customers recently announcing serious cutbacks in its network of providers. It's typical of what's taking place in the market as a whole. Premiums are going up too, as the insurance companies struggle with too few young, healthy, profitable buyers and too many older, sicker, expensive ones. What's happening to Obamacare? Is it sustainable? What are some possible fixes? With me now is the CEO of Oscar, Mario Schlosser. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here.
And Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President for Health Initiatives at the New York Community Service Society. She's both a policy advocate and an on-the-ground navigator who advises individuals on their New York State Affordable Care Act exchange choices. She has been with us many times to help us understand the Affordable Care Act and how it affects you as individuals. So, hi, Elizabeth. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, and thank you, Brian.
Mr. Schlosser, give us the current realities as you see them. Why is Oscar pulling out of New Jersey and shrinking its provider network in New York?
Yeah. Might help to take a bit of a step back first and say how we started the company, why we did that, and what the company is. So, we are an insurance company that wants our members to call us. We want to guide you very actively through the healthcare system. I started the company 4 years ago when my wife was pregnant with the first kids. I had no idea how I would find a good pediatrician, how much the pregnancy would cost me. I was confused by the so-called explanation of benefits, the cryptic statements you get from your insurance companies. And you ask the average person on the street, you ask yourself, who is your insurer? And the reaction it gets, people pulling their wallet out, looking at this ID cards full of, you know, garbled text and not really knowing who they should turn to in order to navigate the complex healthcare system. And so against those realities, we started Oscar. And those realities, I think, are much bigger than any which insurance markets. Over the past 4 years, what we mostly spent our time on is building technology, building products and user experiences to make sure the system gets simplified as an Oscar member.
What do you mean building technology, building user experiences? Yeah. Maybe people are thinking of Uber, which calls itself a technology company, not a transportation company. But people just want to be able to go to the doctor and get reimbursed or not have to pay out of pocket.
Exactly. Your kid, my kid, is crying at 3 a.m. in the morning. You know, what can I do? Under Oscar, I take out a mobile application, push a button, a doctor will call me back 24/7. A pediatrician, he can write a prescription. Our systems know where the prescription ought to go, which pharmacy it goes to. They alert you when the prescription is there. When you call us, when you chat with us, when you meet us in person, we always have the same four people in a member services team deal with you directly. It's your personal concierge team. They will get to know you, your health history incredibly well. They will know in real time when you ended up in the emergency room. They will reach out to you directly after, help you navigate what happens next. Those are all the things, the experience we get.
So that's the kind of customer service that you offer, concierge service as you call it. But then, why is Oscar pulling out of New Jersey and shrinking its provider network in New York?
Yeah, exactly. I think the most important thing to understand really is the insurance industry as we have it today wasn't really built around the individuals and the experience of you and me. It was built largely to satisfy HR departments and employers, which is why generally the statements you get are meant to be read by a computer or a person in the HR department, not by you individually. And so that is what, in our opinion, the ACA created as a huge opportunity for us. Finally, there was a market where individuals can actually choose and vote with their feet as to which insurance company they want to buy. Now, two things happened. One thing you mentioned, which is other insurance companies, in particular the big insurance companies, are pulling out of many, many markets. You know, if you look at our footprints, we decided to leave New Jersey, decided to leave one city in Texas, Dallas. We're remaining in other cities in Texas, and we're actually expanding into San Francisco. So our footprints, when Aetna reduces footprint by 90%, we are actually about the same for next year. We believe wholeheartedly in the fundamentals and the philosophy of the individual markets. I think in 10 years from now, everybody should be able to individually select health insurance. But so we cannot entirely ignore the fact that large insurers are moving out. In markets like Fort Worth, for example, there used to be seven insurers competing, finally competing, competition in these markets, you know, driving value for the consumer. Now there's one left for the next year. That is in a situation where we, as a company that has to grow in a measured way, you know, we grew over the last three years now to 135,000 members. We want to keep growing in a measured way, is a reality we can't ignore. And the second thing...
So you have to cut your losses in places like New Jersey if you're spending more than you're taking in to a certain by a certain amount.
In a place like New Jersey where another co-op now recently was just taken into conservatorship by the states, we have to first and foremost also make sure that we don't just double, triple, quadruple overnight in terms of membership. You know, that is where we want to grow more measured. I think the other thing...
You went to zero for the moment.
For the moment.
Elizabeth, what's the larger context here for people you advise in New York State? What will their Obamacare, and you only do New York, so I can't ask you specifically to address New Jersey, but what will their Obamacare options look like next year in price and quality compared with this year?
Well, I mean, I sort of have a different take than you do. Usually I'm quite in agreement with you, Brian, but I think, what the census data shows this week is that Obamacare is working, not that it's not working. So, for example, in New York, 3 years ago, we had 2.7 million uninsured. Now we have 1.38 million people. So, you know, nothing works overnight. I mean, I wish we could do something as big as complicated and have it, you know, work just like that. But I think we're, like, doing incredibly well. And in fact, the Journal of American Medical Association showed, you know, between 2010 and 2015, the uninsurance rate went from 16% to 9.1% in America. So that's the lowest rate of uninsured people ever. I mean, since they ever started even keeping these statistics. So, you know, I think it's working pretty good. I think the other thing that you need to remember, at least in New York, you know, we have a very strong young people enrollment. I think a lot of young people are coming to the marketplace in droves. The thing about young people is that they tend to have lower incomes because they're just starting out or they're not working at all. And so a lot of those young people are going into the public insurance products like Medicaid and Essential Plan and may not go into the more expensive, you know, relatively qualified health plans or, you know, being full pay qualified health plans, which are the, you know, commercial products on the exchange like Oscar. So when you look at the marketplace, I think the other thing that we really need to, when we're just focusing on the commercial plans, so we have to, you know, kind of say, okay, here, there's a huge bunch of people getting in these Medicaid expansion states and in states like New York, which rolled out this thing called the Essential Plan, which is low-cost coverage for people below 200% of poverty or around $23,000 a year with only $20 per month premium. So that's pretty cheap. So we have two great kind of quasi, you know, either full public insurance project or product, or what I would call or characterize a quasi public insurance product. We have those great options that have really addressed affordability for New Yorkers. And then as you kind of march up the income level, you know, the Affordable Care Act is a progressive law, things start getting more expensive. And that's when you have a harder time attracting younger people because, you know, insurance is more expensive as you become more wealthy. So the wealthier younger people may not be joining and taking their chances. But I think there's a couple of other forces at play that we haven't seen really kick in. And that's one, I think a lot of people don't understand that almost everybody who goes to the marketplace is eligible for something. The vast majority are eligible for financial assistance or a tax credit of some kind or another, or actual full-on free care, and people don't know about that yet. And so we still have our work cut out for us in getting the word out about that. And then the other thing that's happening is at tax time, people are beginning to realize, uh-oh, there's a penalty, or I have to pay a fine if I don't actually join and show that I have had health coverage throughout the year. So I don't think it's quite as negative as you would say, Brian. I think for, you know, carriers like Oscar have tried some really unique and innovative measures to try to attract people. One of the things that we really saw consumers loving about Oscar when they first rolled it out a couple of years ago was they offered higher deductible plans, which most people say, ew, but then they had a lot of pre-deductible services available to people, and people like well visits or sick visits, and that was really interesting and very attractive to a lot of people. The other thing that Oscar has done to try to save money is, of course, narrow its networks. And, you know, it, quite frankly, consumers are wary of narrowing networks and don't really understand the network situation in a lot of the plans. And, you know, I think the government is doing its level best to make, you know, searching by networks much easier. And that's, you know, a work in progress still.
So, Elizabeth, not to minimize at all the historic success of getting the number of uninsured people, the percentage of uninsured people in the United States down to these low levels. But if it's going to maintain and if it's going to grow to even more of the uninsured, you know, I've seen a few articles now that say because of the mismatch of input and output, you know, clients who need a lot of care versus clients who don't need a lot of care not buying in that much. I've seen a few articles now, like in the Times, that say Obamacare is becoming like Medicaid. Very narrow networks of doctors getting reduced payments compared to employer-based private health insurance. I should say employer-based private health insurance, because this is private too. And at the same time, the premiums are going to go up in some cases by, you know, quite large margins going into 2017. Is any of that wrong?
It kind of is. So, and let me tell you why I think it's wrong. And I was very discouraged by that article. Number one, like I said before, the vast majority of people that go to the marketplace are eligible for financial assistance. So they are, it's the way the marketplace works, you're insulated from insurance prices. So it's pegged at your, you know, level of poverty or your level of wealth, if you will. So it asks, you know, wealthier people to pay more than lower income people. So the vast majority, you know, I can't remember the exact number, 60-70% are eligible for some kind of a financial aid and are completely insulated from insurance carriers' price increases. So I think that's wrong. The other thing that I think was really discouraging about that article is this sort of characterization that the quote-unquote Obamacare plans aren't as good as commercial plans. And I think, you know, if you look at data, and if you look at data in New York State, when they do the quality indicators, in some cases the Medicaid plans, you know, which are supposedly not as good as commercial plans, actually have better quality indicators than some of the commercial plans. And so, you know, we don't yet know Oscars quality ratings. I think they haven't been part of the quality rating pool. But some of the other commercial, the big name, you know, blue ribbon players actually don't do so well on some of their quality indicators and don't appear to be managing people
just,
as well.
Just before we let Ms. Schlosser back in here, what percentage do you expect premiums to go up for 2017 in New York State, Elizabeth?
I think the average is 17%.
17%?
Correct, on average.
That's
a
burden.
So some are more than others.
Yeah.
Except and that, and the reason for that is because, so the last thing, I'm sorry, Brian, there is actually a policy reason for that, and that's that the... you know, Congress is sort of letting the there's a risk adjustment. This is like really wonky, but what's supposed to happen is the government is supposed to insulate the carriers from adverse selection
right.
or you know big sick big tranches
right.
of sick people
right.
coming
from,
in.
From
and so there's this whole risk adjustment process, which has been phased out
from going out of business or pulling out, which many of them are finding it necessary to do. So they say, Mr. Schlosser from Oscar.
Brian, so 70% is a big increase. There's no question about this. Two things you should know about this. Number one, if you look at where premiums will be next, where then this year, there's still 20% where HHS thought 4 years ago they were going to be this year.
20% lower?
20% lower, yes. Exactly. 20% lower. And so clearly the exchanges have succeeded, as Elizabeth was saying, in getting many, many people into health insurance who did not have a chance to get health insurance before. Clearly the exchanges and the fact that there's now a website run by the government, ironically enough, the government innovates in websites, where you can compare prices, has led to price competitiveness in these plans. And the third thing, this is very, very important to understand, show me another health insurance plan where you push a button, doctor calls you back totally free, where you have this pre-deductible coverage that a little bit of talking about that we introduced, where you have a concierge team. We have better services, more innovation, better features changing on a weekly basis than any other plan that you can get out there. What Obamacare did is to enable innovation in new models like this. And the final point to make here is our healthcare system is in trouble. A fifth of your income and of my income is paying for an insanely expensive healthcare system, twice as much as in my home country, Germany, where the care, frankly, is better. That's the underlying issue you have. And what we are now doing is, and others as well, who have now a chance to pitch to individuals who can like us or not like us and vote with their feet on that, we are now finally trying to do something about that, getting you better value for money. And a third of our members are coming in because of word of mouth. If that isn't working, I don't know what is. Tell me that I'm sure where that's the case.
Mario Schlosser with us, CEO of Oscar Health Insurance, and Elizabeth Benjamin with us, Vice President for Health Initiatives at the advocacy group, the New York Community Service Society. She's also a navigator who helps individuals buy policies on the Obamacare exchanges. And listeners, we can take a few questions, your Obamacare questions and your Oscar-specific questions at 212-433-WNYC. And Nina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nina. Nina, are you there? Nina's listening to the radio and has a 7-second delay. I'm going to give her 5 more seconds. 5, 4. Nina, you there?
Yes, I sure am.
Hi, you're on the air.
Great.
Ignore your radio. Just listen to the phone.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I joined Oscar right at when it started, and up until now, I have found it absolutely on a par with Oxford and Blue Cross, you know, which have always been. I'm in New York, really the gold standards in insurance. But I have to say, I'm finding this conversation, the focus is all on generalities, premiums, and not on participation in who's in the HMO. And this sort of, you know, selling the new, you know, concierge services. It's nice to be able to call a doctor at 3 a.m. if you have a cold, but that's hardly what health insurance is really for. It's for really serious things. And I think for this conversation that we need to be really clear that Oscar, I don't know who's at fault, and I'd actually like for the CEO to really address this, and I'm not clear if there are non-disclosure issues or something, but what has happened this fall, because Oscar had a really very extensive list of participating hospitals. It is the only hospitals come 2017 that will be participating are Mount Sinai in Manhattan, Montefiore, which is in the Bronx and insanely far. It's unrealistic.
Depending
for people
on where you live.
Yeah, depending for if you're in Manhattan or Brooklyn, it's great if you're in the Bronx, and someplace in Long Island. So basically for, you know, those of us in the city area, you're what we now have is a Mount Sinai exclusive HMO. And that just, you know, I'm sorry, that doesn't cut it. It's serious.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
Mr.
Nina, absolutely. That's an absolutely valid question and a very good question to ask me, and I'm glad I can answer this directly here. This is how we think about this. Again, I started Oscar because I wanted a better healthcare experience for myself. I had two kids. My wife had two kids in the past 4 years, you know, so I'm very actively using the healthcare system. And I find myself over and over again just not knowing where to go in the system, what to do next, you know, who is really the highest quality physician to see. My son had to get his tonsils taken out, his adenoids, 6 months ago or so. And again, you know, who do I go and see who's the best person to do this in New York? What we said since the very beginning, what we dreamed of was to find exactly the doctors, exactly the hospitals where we can find data and where we can build additional technology to make sure that we get you for whatever happens to you, not just the cold at night, but any kind of complex cancer situation, anything else, the best physician and the right physician to go to. And because we then have the right set of doctors
but
in the right
hospital. But then that doesn't seem consistent with narrowing the network to become what Nina called basically a Mount Sinai HMO.
It is consistent if the doctors you then have in, if we understand them way better, if we have a much more direct link to them, if we have a much better ability of orchestrating and helping you orchestrate your care with the doctors who are in. And that's the partnership. It's not just a network anymore. The partnership we now have with Mount Sinai, for example, you know, that is where we see in real time when you, Nina, went to the emergency room for a complex issue, where we can take over, work with Sinai to really make sure you get the best possible experience and the best possible care there. Sinai has the largest number of doctors on the New York Magazine Best Doctors lists. You know, we will get you somebody and more quickly than with any other insurance company to go to.
But let me follow up both on the realities for patients, and we're getting a number of calls like Nina's, I should say. Mm-hmm. And how you are framing it. Like a friend of mine who has Oscar on the New York Exchange was pretty put off by the notice that you sent to customers, consistent with your cheery, "Hi, Oscar," slogan when delivering this bad news. The email was addressed team@hioscar.com. That's to the customers. Restates your goal of improving health care. Tells that same success story about your own kids and the tonsillitis, for example. And then tucked in there is, our new network will not contain every hospital or doctor we have today, but this is a good and necessary change. Nevertheless, there will be some healthcare critics entrenched in their views in an outdated system who will say we are only changing our network to improve our bottom line. Are you really selling less doctor choice as a good thing?
Take us up on that. If you are a member, and if you're a member next year at Oscar, look back at that year, compare to the service level you've gotten from us and from the physicians who you will go to and get service from, and then make that decision. You will have my commitments that this will be a better experience and that this will work better for you than the way it does. Here's the other reason in the U.S. Again, I want to come back to this as well. We have not talked enough about cost, in my opinion, either. In the New York healthcare system, the healthcare markets, I can get the same, let's say, colonoscopy or the same radiology procedure for a factor of 5 in difference. That is what's leading these crazy cost disparities that have nothing to do with quality. Many academic studies show it's no correlation.
In other words, by giving Mount Sinai and however much of its network you've contracted with exclusivity, you're getting procedures and patient care at a greatly reduced rate,
and that flows directly through to the member as well. Exactly.
And
that is
Elizabeth, that's exactly the trade-off that Americans hope not to have to make. That to have affordable care, they have to have narrower and narrower choices in medicine. Are you even saying this is a good thing?
I think it's the reality that there's a consolidated look. The first thing that we had to do was, you know, you have cost, quality, and access on a triangle when you're thinking about health policy. I learned this in health policy like when I went to college, right? My first health policy class. And it's a triangle. And those days they said you can only have two. Well, we as a country have decided to have all three. We've decided to have you know, costs. I mean, you've decided to have everybody have access for the most part, although there's very important group of undocumented immigrants that have been left behind, and that's a problem. We need to address it. We have a, you know, high quality system, arguably, and but we also have an expensive system. And I think, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, we're really trying to address the access issue. We've done a, you know, we're really on our way there. I think, you know, in some cases you can get people say we have the best quality healthcare system, but I think the cost quality nexus really has to be addressed. And, you know, what most health policy folks are now saying is that the way to do that is by really integrating and consolidating healthcare in the industry. And that's the reality of what's happening right now. And we see that happening through all the, you know, financing vehicles. And so even folks with job-based coverage, which, you know, would arguably be the gold standard, you're seeing networks tightening and shrinking. So it's a phenomena because that's one of the levers that insurance, commercial insurance, has to control costs in our really, really expensive healthcare system. Another thing we're seeing is hospital consolidations. I mean, we're down to five major, you know, the big five major networks in New York City: Montefiore System, the Mount Sinai System, the New York Presbyterian System, the NYU System, and the Health and Hospitals System. Oh, and then the Northwell. So six, you know, major healthcare systems. And we used to have many, many more. We're seeing hospitals close in Brooklyn and Queens. That's really a travesty because folks now have to travel farther for health care. But it's just the nature of the beast. Until we really start having some hard conversations about health care costs and our delivery system, it's going to be a problem. And I want to say one thing. It's not, these costs are not being driven by overutilization by consumers. That's a myth. Our average length of stays in hospitals in amongst Americans is much lower than their European counterparts. It's really about other system drivers like the pharmaceutical costs, medical equipment costs, you know, the salary structure in the healthcare system in the United States is sort of disproportionate to all the other world, you know, nations and, you know, sort of, you know, European look-alike, arguably look-alike nations. So it's really complicated. So I'm sorry, that's a pretty long answer.
Well, it's still not going to satisfy people who feel that they're choices are going down and down and down, and that's exactly what the rebellion against HMOs way back in the 90s was supposed to be against, and now everybody's saying, well, this is the only way to keep
because costs
under control.
Because it was poorly done.
I think the rebellion
done,
in the 90s was about getting the permission slip, right? I mean, I think the rebellion wasn't so much about the limitations of the networks, but that you had to have this gatekeeper that was saying no.
It was poorly executed. That is, to me, very, very important. Yeah. Again, if we, the only choice to get costs down in this country, if the only choice had been to build networks around low-cost and low-quality doctors, that would be an issue. That's not what this is. This is a network around the premier academic medical center in the country and the best doctors in the city with a way better experience of actually getting to those doctors. What good are 40,000 doctors if you can't see any before 6 weeks from now? That's the reality of this country. And if half of them are overcharging you by crazy amounts. The HMO rebellion was because the member experience was a very, very poor one. Go on, Oscar. I would invite you to do that. Also experience, Nina, and this is back to you a little bit, experience what we are going to work through with you over the next few weeks. We are very actively working with members who are going to have to transition to other doctors, getting them into those doctors, advising them on their choices, making appointments for them. That is what we do, and that has never been done before.
Well, let me give you one more customer to talk to who I think has that specific problem. Monica in Red Hook, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monica.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I want to say, first of all, with Oscar, from day one, everything that the CEO has mentioned in terms of customer service, software, access, understandability has been 100% spot on, and that's why we have loved Oscar. However, premiums went up last year, but the network expanded, so we went through with that, even though our deductible was also much higher. This year, with the narrowing of services and, I'm assuming, a premium increase, we're probably going to change. And I just want to say, as a small business person, I feel that there's an upfront investment. When you're dealing with millions of people who have been uninsured, the first few years are going to be more expensive because they're getting up to speed. They are bringing their health up to date. It's not going to be an ongoing
expense at that level. I had a surgery last year that I needed, and it was amazing. I'm not going to need that again next year or the year after. And I think by narrowing your services, you're going to lose people who will be less expensive to insure in the long time.
You're planning to leave Oscar now because your doctor won't be included?
I don't know if my doctor's going to be included in the new change. I'm not sure. But I'm not necessarily wed to one doctor. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that it's going to be narrowing altogether, right, and the premium goes up, okay, and the deductible goes up.
Are you at least going to have the entire Mount Sinai network, including, yeah, the real Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai doctors, not just the satellite ones?
No, and more doctors, of course. We have a very complex algorithm that goes by quality, by value for money, by cost, to find doctors who should be in the network and who we can connect to differently. We have photos of doctors you can select from. We know exactly who goes to the doctors. If I need a doctor who sees patients in his 30s, for example, I can find that through Oscar. We do that very actively. I want to say just briefly again, Monica, I think, was the name. Yeah. I'd love to give you a call afterwards and talk you through this directly. The service level you are going to get, not just from Oscar, but from the healthcare system we represent, is going to go up next year. Just as of next week, you'll be able to chat with your doctors. We've become the first insurer to actually pay doctors for chatting with you from your mobile phone, for example. Those are powerful things that will, I think, create a better experience for you. And I think you are absolutely right that there is upfront investments in members who now are getting insured for the first time. And Brian, I do think that that makes me want to make one additional point. There has been a lack of care taken on the part of the government of how the Obamacare reform has worked. That is the other issue that's afflicted us and others. If you look at new insurance markets like Medicare Advantage, they took 5 or 6 years and, you know, tinkering, fixing of issues of the governments before they really start working. Now it's a fantastic choice, Medicare Advantage, you know, 5, 10 years later or so. The same will happen in Obamacare. We are working very actively with regulators on that. And we'll this will be the market, I think, mark my words, where in a few years from now, we're going to look back at this and say, finally created competition, innovation, the right models, and I also think more affordability and better systems.
And as we wrap this up, Elizabeth Benjamin from the Community Service Society, just in our last minute, what Mario Schlosser said there about the government, Hillary Clinton is proposing a public option to compete with Oscar and the others, or at least provide, you know, an alternative when the market seems to be failing a lot of people. What do you want to see as an advocate the next administration do, if they can, just in a minute or less?
In a minute or less, I think the public option is a really interesting idea and should be explored. But in the meantime, open enrollment's coming up. People can start making their selections as of November 15th and come back to the marketplace. Come to a navigator. Shop around. There's lots of great options out there on the marketplace. We're really lucky in New York. We have lots of great carriers and lots of, you know, really great financial aid system. And, you know, there's something for everyone, essentially. So please come to the New York State of Health, go to a local navigator, sit down and talk with somebody in person to make the right choice for you and your family.
And did we get Monica's contact info? Okay, good. So she's going to take you up on that, Mr. Schlosser. And we thank you very much.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
Elizabeth Benjamin from the Community Service Society, Mario Schlosser, CEO of Oscar Health Insurance. Thank you.
Thank you.
On WNYC, researchers looking for funding and finding it from the industries they're investigating sounds like a recipe for bad data. And sure enough, a new article published this week in JAMA Internal Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine, finds that the sugar industry seems to have managed to influence a generation's thinking about the health risks of sugar by funding Harvard researchers to shift the focus to saturated fat as a risk for heart disease. To talk about what happened back in 1967 and what it means going forward, I'm joined by Marion Nessel, a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU, and author of books including Food Politics, which is also the name of her blog. Some of her other books include, most recently, Soda Politics. Hi, Professor Nessel. Welcome back to WNYC. And I see you wrote a commentary on the JAMA Internal Medicine article. You, as kind of a skeptic about, you know, the big food industries in the first place, did you learn anything new here?
I was absolutely shocked. And I never thought I could be at what the sugar industry did in this particular case. It's very hard to get documentary evidence of industry involvement with the research that they fund. In the food industry funds lots of research, and there's nothing wrong with that in theory. But when the industry executives are closely involved in telling the investigators what they want at the end of the study, which is what they did with these Harvard investigators, and the Harvard investigators went along with it and were paid a great deal of money to participate in this particular instance, which came out showing that exonerating sugar from any risk for heart disease and shifting the blame quite heavily to saturated fat. Personally, I think both of them are of concern, and they should be. If you're eating a lot of sugary foods and you're eating a lot of foods with saturated fat, which means meat mainly, mm-hmm. then your risk for heart disease is going to increase. We know this.
As I understand it, the main way the researchers were able to shift blame away from sugar was by disputing the studies linking sugar consumption to heart disease, but not finding similar so-called problems with the same findings on saturated fat?
Exactly. And the analysis in the JAMA Internal Medicine paper is really quite remarkable. They go through the studies that the Harvard investigators reviewed line by line and show how if there were problems with the sugar data, those were pointed out very carefully. If there were problems with the data for saturated fat, those were kind of ignored. And this was exactly what the Sugar Association wanted. It specified to the Harvard investigators that it was extremely worried about a certain set of papers. And the Harvard investigators said, don't worry, we'll take care of it.
Coverage of this in the Times and other outlets suggests that this Harvard study came at a pivotal time back in the 60s and influenced nutritional guidelines and the whole low-fat food craze that we've had for like two generations since. Is that how you see it?
Well, I don't know whether you can pinpoint it to that particular set of studies, because there were many studies coming out, and nobody was paying much attention to who was funding what in those days, and investigators were not required to say who had funded their studies until starting in the 1980s. So you don't really know, and then you'd have to go back in retrospect and try to figure this out. But there was a lot of debate about sugar. A high sugar diets raise triglycerides in the blood, and there were many, many debates about whether triglycerides constituted a risk factor for coronary artery disease or not. So this didn't help clarify anything, and it certainly discouraged people who might have been interested in pursuing studies of sugar from bothering to do that because they didn't show much. And I remember a FDA study that came out in 1985 that completely exonerated sugar from any connection with heart disease risk, and it did not cite these particular papers.
And we should be clear, this news is in no way suggesting that saturated fat is any less of a risk, right? It's just that
That's
they both are.
I think they both are. And, you know, we don't eat saturated fat and sugar. We eat foods containing them. And so this is an example of nutritionism using individual nutrients to stand for diets that are much more complicated. And the real questions have to do with the kinds of foods and diets that people are eating and the calories, which don't come up in this particular context at all. But the part that, you know, one of the parts that really disturbed me was that the New England Journal of Medicine reviews from 1967 did not fully disclose who had paid for the studies, and they didn't mention the Sugar Research Foundation at all. They did mention some other food entities, the Dairy Council and the Nutrition Foundation, which was funded by the food industry, and also a fund at Harvard, which was well known to be funded by the food industry. But they didn't bother to mention the Sugar Association. They must have forgotten.
Just slipped their mind. But do you think, seriously, that this was an instance of bias or an instance of corruption. And they're different because maybe because of the money that they got and the relationships that they developed with people in the sugar industry, they looked at these studies and they saw them a certain way. That would be bias.
Yeah,
where corruption is, I don't believe this, but I'm putting it out because I was paid to do so.
Yeah, I vote for bias. There's very, very little in evidence that industry funding, and there's been a huge body of research examining this, there's hardly any evidence that money buys results. Instead, it's much more complicated. The financing influences people in ways that they don't recognize, that they're unaware of, that they certainly didn't intend to happen, and that they deny had any effect on what they were doing. This makes the whole area of conflicted research very, very difficult to study.
And in your commentary, you point to continuing connections between nutritional scientists and the food industry. Do you think something that egregious could go on today?
Well, we know it does because of the investigative report that the New York Times did last year of Coca-Cola's funding of investigators at the University of Colorado who were part of the Global Energy Balance Network. And they had, the Times got emails that showed very, very similar kinds of discussions to the kinds of discussions that the Sugar Association was having with the Harvard investigators in 1967. So, yes, it continues.
I'll just throw in the Times Upshot article on Monday, which found that teenagers made better food choices after they read articles like this one about the sugar industry vilifying big food than when given a straight-up explanation of how food affects health. For you as a public health and nutrition educator, and we have 30 seconds, was that eye-opening?
Isn't that wonderful? That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm writing about big food, and I hope that teenagers read it.
In books like Food Politics and Soda Politics, Professor Marian Nestle, political consciousness might lead to better food choices than telling people that broccoli is good for you and candy bars aren't. Found that study, and thanks for talking about the 1967 study and what it means.
Always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.